Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Robert A. Williams, Jr. He's a member of the Lumbee Indian Tribe and a professor of law at the University of Arizona Indigenous Peoples Law Program. He's the author of numerous books and articles on Indigenous peoples' human rights, including The American Indian and Western Legal Thought and Like a Loaded Weapon. Today we talk about his book Savage Anxieties, The Invention of Western Civilization. So first, thank you for your really important work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. It's my pleasure.
So I want to start with the first sentence of the introduction to Savage Anxieties, which is, from its very beginnings in ancient Greece, Western civilization has sought to invent itself through the idea of the savage. So what does that mean?
Yeah, you know, I've done work all over the world representing indigenous peoples here in the United States, in Canada, in Australia, in Taiwan. And I would always encounter this idea of the savage, that indigenous tribal peoples were uncivilized, were backwards. The criteria that I would hear were always the same, whether it was dealing with Aboriginal folks in Australia or the Maori in New Zealand. They thought about property differently. Their laws weren't as sophisticated as Western civilization. And it was always the tribal peoples, no matter where they were, whether it was in Africa or Asia or the U.S., North America, the standard that they were always measured against and found wanting was Western civilization. And so having encountered this idea in so many different places and seen its incredible destructive energy, so many of the policies that have resulted in genocide of indigenous peoples emanate from this idea that they're somehow inferior and not and dehumanized. I wanted to find out, you know, where did this powerful idea come from? I kept on going back and back and back, and I stopped really at the beginnings of Western civilization in ancient Greece. And right there in the first books ever published and written down in the West, Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, we encounter this idea of the savage throughout both of those poems, which have been called the Bible of Greek civilization and in many ways the secular Bible of Western civilization. You go back to Odysseus's encounter with the one-eyed Cyclops. I mean, every kid knows about the one-eyed Cyclops. Most of us remember the myths of centaurs. There's a great scene in Homer's poems about a battle of Greek heroes versus savage centaurs. And what I identified in those early Greek sources, going through Homer, going through works by Hesiod, for example, Works and Days, going through Greek sculpture, Greek art, are this idea of the savage is articulated around two different poles. On the one hand, there's this ignoble savage, the bestial, sort of uncivilized, dangerous, brooding savage that needs to be conquered and colonized. And then there's this idea of the noble savage, which you actually find all the way back in the Greeks. We tend to think that the idea of the noble savage was somehow developed by Rousseau and the French Enlightenment in the 17th and 18th century. But it actually, the idea goes all the way back to the earliest Greek poems, Greek tragedies of both a noble and ignoble side. And I trace that idea all the way up through Rome and the Roman Empire, through the medieval Christian church, through the Renaissance, the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, into our own founding, and up until the 21st century debates, for example, on indigenous rights at the United Nations. And what you find, and this is what my book tries to capture, is this really 3,000-year-old story of this inherent conflict between savagery and particularly Western civilization. And by the time I got done my research and writing the book, what I recognized was, you know, basic truth about critical theory and critical thought is that we need our opposites to define ourselves. And what I not necessarily discovered but came to a realization was that Western civilization has really defined itself by what it isn't. It isn't savage. It doesn't have the types of legal systems and tribal systems that other cultures have. So it's this idea of the savagery set up in opposition to the West that the West has used to define itself, even to use it to define its own discontents, this idea of the noble savage, that, you know, humans had it better when we lived simply, when we didn't, when we could rely on nature, for example, when we didn't have sophisticated laws and didn't have large-scale warfare, for example, simple technological societies. Oftentimes, this idea of the noble savage is used again to help the West understand its own deficiencies, perhaps. And then again, of course, throughout the history of Western warfare against non-Western peoples, the idea of the noble savage, which is basically the enemy in this process of othering, plays itself out continuously. So the book, in many ways, and I'm glad you did pick that first sentence, it really is a story of this defining idea of what Western civilization is not and what it might become. This defining idea of the savage traces all the way back to the Greeks, and it's a continuous theme throughout Western history.
So help me understand why, you've sort of said this, but I'm still having a hard time understanding, what do the, what does Western civilization gain by perpetuating these myths? Why do they do it?
Oh, sure. I mean, we can look to the news currently, and remember sort of the justifications for the war in Afghanistan, these, tribal peoples living in the mountains, backwards and barbarous. Oftentimes, the idea that the savage is used in the West, to quite frankly, to ginny up a war, to justify going to war. And you can find this in the Crusades. This language of savagery was used by the medieval Christian church to ostracize and to other the Muslim infidel Turks, for example. You find this, for example, in World War II and use of savage imagery to describe Japanese. Oftentimes, look at the American Indian and look at the West, the wars in the West, that it was this fight against savagery. The founding fathers themselves defined their own mission into the wilderness as the conquest of civilization over savagery. So on the one hand, the West, by identifying this opposite of what it isn't, can oftentimes mobilize its own will to power. It's, look at colonialism going all the way through European colonialism, beginning in Africa in the 1500s, and then through the Americas and the rest of the world, was oftentimes justified by this language of savagery. And it was Joseph Conrad in The Heart of Darkness who said, the conquest of the world isn't a pretty thing when you look at it. What justifies it is the idea at the heart of it. And so this notion of the ignoble savage, the dangerous savage, can certainly be used in the West by politicians, by policymakers, by religious leaders to justify conquest, colonization. On the other hand, I've identified a strain of this language of savagery, which really focuses on what we call the noble savage, the idea of, again, living simply. Many environmentalists, going all the way back to Hesiod, I actually traced the first environmentalist as this Greek poet who's contemporaneous with Homer, named Hesiod, who wrote this wonderful work called Works and Days. And it talks about the hard scrabble life of the peasant farmer in 8th century BC Greece, who's impoverished by foreign wars and by conscription and by heavy taxes to pay for these wars. And he harkens back to the Golden Age, when men lived at the beginning of time and lived off of nature. And these environmental strains get replicated throughout the Middle Ages, for example, by the church. We know that the church tried to suppress much of the literature of classical Greece and Rome. But they're survived in various modes. For example, the Wandering Goliards were this singing group of friars who had been defrocked, who would go from town to town and sing Latin verse of these old Golden Age myths, where you didn't need, for example, a savior, but men live without the Christian notions of God. So oftentimes the language of savagery has been used as a critique of Western civilization, and so it really is it's a critical apparatus in and of itself.
So everything you're saying makes perfect sense, and I'm also thinking that there are some differences between Western civilization and many indigenous peoples. I mean, for example, I live on Tolowa land, and it's simply true that the Tolowa lived here for 12,500 years, if you believe science, and lived here since the beginning of time, if you believe the Tolowa, and they didn't destroy the place. And the place is getting hammered. And also, the Ptolemy did not conquer the ancient Greeks, but the Greeks and Western civilization have conquered the world and pretty much committed genocide against everybody. So obviously there are some differences between civilized and indigenous perspectives, which is not to say that which is not to undercut the notion of the civilized I'll just shut up. There obviously are some differences between the way, you know, I interviewed Vine Deloria years ago, and yeah, he, like so many people, has he mentioned the thing to me about indigenous peoples not needing a savior.
Right.
He said that same thing. So you're not suggesting that there are not different ways to live. You're suggesting a specific what?
Yeah, it's the criteria that Western civilization uses to either condemn or lionize certain ways to live. And what's happened in the Western encounter with tribal peoples, whether it goes back to the Greeks, for example, the Greeks did not have what we would call color prejudice. It wasn't necessarily skin color that earned you the term barbarian. Anybody who didn't speak Greek was barbaros, an onomatopoeic term, which meant you were a babbler. But the black Ethiopians, Homer describes as among the most noble peoples in the world. They lived a simple, pure existence close to nature. And clearly, you know, this Western encounter with tribal civilizations, the Greeks, and I make the point in my book, were the first great colonizing imperial civilization of the West. That Western civilization, and what I do try to show in my mode, is that when it gears up into this sort of imperial conquest colonizing mode, in the people that it encounters, who are non-Westerners, what happens is that this language of savagery provides the normative criteria to justify conquest, colonization, forced conversion, the Inquisition. And so what's peculiar to the West, I mean, this idea of savagery versus civilization is not peculiar to the West. Let me make that point. For example, the Navajo, they have a term for, you know, you're either the people or you're everybody else, you're uncivilized. China used a language of savagery to justify the conquest of indigenous Taiwanese people, for example. You find this language of dichotomies between savagery and civilization throughout all cultures. What's distinctive and what's unique about the West is how this language has been used to permeate virtually every aspect of Western culture, whether it's its art, its literature, its modes of warfare, its laws of war, for example, are all organized around this identifying concept of the distinctiveness and the difference between Western civilization and tribal peoples. And quite frankly, oftentimes it's the intensity of land use, scales of economy, it's modes of subsistence. It's at those points of conflict in which the West has the greatest interest, for example, in acquiring resources, overseas resources, of acquiring other people's labor, that this discourse of savagery becomes most pronounced.
You know, you years and years ago, I interviewed Robert J. Lifton, who has written extensively about the psychology of genocide. And one of the things he talks about is how before you can commit any mass atrocity, you have to convince yourself and other people that you're not committing an atrocity, but instead you are actually having what he calls a claim to virtue, that you're actually doing a good thing. And so in the minds of the Nazis, they were not actually committing genocide, but instead purifying the Aryan race. And so we can see what you're talking about as a claim to virtue. But in addition, you use the word obsession. That this is not merely a claim to virtue, but it is an obsession in Western civilization. Can you talk about the obsession?
Yeah, it's first of all, I have some material in the book on some of the psychosexual fantasies that the West has organized around the idea of savagery, and tied that directly to stereotypes of Native women in the United States and the high rates of sexual violence that have been perpetuated against Native women. And again, it comes out of this idea that Native women are somehow less human, that they are more readily available to Western men, because of their savage nature, their quote savage nature, they don't share in the sexual mores of the West. And these stereotypes, as Amnesty International pointed out in its study on domestic violence in the United States against Native women, these stereotypes have profound effects. So, you know, on the one hand, when we think about the power of this language in the West, particularly, what we really are thinking about is an obsessive mindset, which immediately turns to these categories of, for example, if you look at the current controversy right now in the Middle East, it focuses on law and institutions of law and legal culture. It's obviously one of the big battle lines between East and West right now is over sexual mores. And so oftentimes these notions of civilization and savagery are integrated into, you know, Western culture at such a deep level that it defines, you know, how we raise our children, what we educate them, what we teach them, what they learn. And so in many ways, it's a psychological obsession in eradicating savagery in many instances. You mentioned Vine DeLauria, and I think Vine makes a great point in a number of his books, is that Western civilization justified its conquest of Indian people, justified, for example, the genocidal cleansing of the eastern United States with the five civilized tribes, justified forcibly removing Indian children from their homes and putting them in boarding schools, justified all this on the idea that we're doing this for their own good, that we're, it was General Pratt, one of the leaders of the Indian boarding school mission system, who said, kill the Indian and save the man. It was this notion that by eradicating savagery, by removing the savage Indian tribes, for example, throughout the continental United States, that the U.S. Would fulfill this great messianic mission, its manifest destiny of spreading, white Protestant conquering, colonizing culture throughout the continent. So when I talk about it being an obsession, it really is this intensive focus on difference and highlighting those differences through the use of stereotypes, for example, to justify whatever actions the West feels it needs to justify.
Let me know if this does or doesn't apply to what we're talking about. It feels to me like it does, but we'll see. That for a book I've got coming out next year, I was looking into, for whatever reason, I read an article in the Atlantic Monthly from a couple years ago about the 100 greatest inventions since the time, since the wheel or something like that. And the thing I found really interesting was that essentially all of the technologies they were talking about, all of the inventions, were something was considered to be a good invention if it increased your ability to dominate and control at a distance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, for example, gunpowder was a great invention. And, I can't think of others off the top of my head, but atomic bomb was one of them. And there were others that were more subtle, but they still had to do with domination and control. And I'm just saying this in terms of you talked earlier about how this notion of conquering the savage infuses every part of our life. And when I read the article in The Atlantic, it made me think that it goes to the heart of our notion of what we think is a good invention, too. Right. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. And you can extend it beyond the realm of convention, inventions. You were talking about, there are differences between tribal indigenous societies and Western societies, for example. One of them is in the realm of diplomacy. You might want to add in there that diplomacy was one of the great inventions of the West, except we all know that all cultures have diplomatic relations. But in the West, diplomacy, and I always make this point when I teach federal Indian law and indigenous people's rights, in the West, diplomacy and treaties have been used to divide people, to put Protestants on one side of a border line and Catholics on the other, to put Spaniards on one side and Portuguese on the other. And so diplomacy, we tend to think of Machiavelli, for example, in Advice to the Prince. So diplomacy is one of these inventions the West uses, again, to extend its domination and control. When Europeans come to the New World, when Europeans come to Australia, to New Zealand, what they do is they encounter totally different traditions of diplomacy. For example, in North America, the point of diplomacy was not to, to draw border lines, but to erase them, to eat out of the same bowl together, which was one of the terms oftentimes used in treaty relations, which means to share your hunting grounds, to link arms together, to form an alliance. Oftentimes in Indian diplomacy, Europeans would be adopted into a tribe and given a clan name. And so diplomacy from an indigenous tribal perspective is oftentimes focused on cementing relationships, creating relationships of trust. That's where the idea of the trust doctrine comes in federal Indian law. It's when tribes sign treaties with the U.S. government. For the government, those treaties were sort of designed to get Indians out of the way and to speed them to assimilation. And you could make a promise for as long as the grass grows and the river flows, because they were a doomed civilization anyway. You wouldn't have to worry about the reservations. For Indians, a treaty was a relationship of peace and friendship that was to last in perpetuity. So there's, a, you know, and again, if your idea about the use of diplomacy is to create and cement what I call, you know, Indians were the first practitioners of multicultural diplomacy. If it was to create these strong multicultural relationships, and you put those traditions up against a tradition which sees diplomacy as a method of artifice and advancing the interest of your own monarch or your own sovereign at the expense of, you know, what, you know, might makes right and the ends justify the means, you can begin to see that there are some fundamental differences organized around these two very different types of cultures.
You know, I'm thinking of two examples of what you're saying. One of them is that I think Philip Sheridan, before the was it Washita? Is that how you say it? Washita? I don't know how to say the word.
Washita?
Washita. Before the massacre at Washita, he one of the part of his language was that we will extend the olive branch with one hand while we go forward with the sword with the other. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to contrast that with I know that the peoples who live along the Columbia River had, not only did they have special relationships and sacred relationships with the salmon, but they also had hard-headed policy agreements that lasted for literally hundreds of years as to who could take how many salmon.
Right.
And that's exact. That's, you can't get more literal eating out of the same bowl than you can eating out of the same river.
That's right. And it was a note, you know, another, you know, misconception that again derives from this language of savagery is that Indians and indigenous peoples have no sense of property. And of course, that was used to justify, you know, taking Indian occupied land. It wasn't even recognized as ownership. Yet, as the example you give on the Columbia River or up throughout British Columbia and the Salish tribes there who, you know, go into the longhouse, and all the tribal leaders will sit around a large table in the longhouse and they'll sing a song, and that song will actually be the description of their traditional boundaries, what can be caught there, what can't be caught, what can be gathered, what can't be gathered. And they'll all go around the circle and sing those songs to each other, reminding each other that this is their law. It's a law of oral tradition. And again, in the West, if it's not written down, it doesn't count. But you can begin to say, to sense a much different ethic, a tribal ethic at work, which, you know, quite frankly, doesn't stand up very well against the more sort of power dynamics and focus on absorption, assimilation, and domination that these Western paradigms tend to focus on.
You know, you talked earlier about the, and everything you're saying is just wonderful, thank you. And you talked earlier about how some of the ramifications on this notion of savagery and the conquest have had and continue to have harmful effects on women. And I just want to mention also the indigenous women being disappeared in British Columbia as we speak.
Sure.
And can you talk a bit more explicitly about the relationship that, okay, what we're talking about is projection, right?
Right.
And a partly projection. And can you talk a bit more about the sort of creation of the, or the feminization of the savage? How did you put it in your book?
Yeah. The sexy savages.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And so one of the things, you know, I quite frankly, am not an expert on feminist theory. I did a lot of reading, and what I kept getting to was that most of our ideas of Western femininity originate with the Greeks and the Romans. And if you go and you read Aristotle, for example, if you read the other Greek philosophers, if you read the Greek tragic and comic playwrights, they all put forward this idea of the ideal woman. And the ideal Greek woman is a wife. She's domestic. She doesn't participate in politics. She stays in the home. She runs a good household economy, but she's extremely deferential to her husband, doesn't speak in his presence or around his friends. Then you contrast that idea, and again, that's basically the notion of the ideal feminine in the West up until not too long ago, in the 1950s, in fact. So, you know, here's an image of Western femininity that goes back almost 3,000 years. Also going back 3,000 years is the idea of the sexy savage. The Amazons, for example, you know, most of us think of the Amazons and maybe we think about Linda Carter and Wonder Woman, but the Amazons are actually a tribe of women warriors that you locate in ancient Greek mythology, and we think there may be a basis in fact, but the mythology around the Amazons and the Greek mentality was they were everything that an ideal Greek woman should not be. They were warriors, they rode horses, they would raid neighboring villages and kidnap the men and castrate them and turn them into slaves. They had loose sexual mores, and so that they could easily trap an unsuspecting Greek or Roman soldier. And this notion of sort of this idea of the Amazon, of the sexy savage, of a woman whose morals and place within the family were totally different from the West, continues all the way through the Middle Ages. Of course, we know, I talk in the book about the witchcraft trials. Many of the tribal religions throughout Europe, you know, we think about the West as being at war with tribalism beginning with Columbus. But if you actually, you know, as I point out in my book, most of the great Roman conflicts, many of the great Greek conquests were against tribal peoples. Charlemagne's conquest of the tribes of the German tribes of Middle Europe. The tribes of Poland and Lithuania is conquered by the various crusading era knightly priestly orders. You know, these are all examples of the West and its continuing war with tribalism. And it doesn't necessarily have to be relegated to non-European tribes. The European tribes were really wiped out by about the time of 1200, 1300. And so just like this idea of the tribe and Europe being at war with the tribe extends throughout history, so does this idea of this difference between, you know, what we would consider today to be a liberated woman. You know, look at the fight we've had to get women into the army and sexual equality in all those realms. And oftentimes you can actually translate those contemporary battles into terms that are organized around this idea of, you know, what's a civilized woman versus a savage woman and who's desirable and who isn't for those very reasons. Now, what's interesting is that you mentioned the disappeared indigenous women in British Columbia. And again, that's an example of what happens when you have this culture, this tradition, this, you know, 3,000-year-old stereotyping of indigenous women as not counting as much, as perhaps living by a different code, as whatever happens to them should be expected. And so therefore the police, so all the sort of stereotypes used to justify racism and sexism against Native women have a very long, and I'll say a paternity, going back 3,000 years in Western history. And you can, you know, Victoria's, you see this in fashion today, for example, in the appropriation of Indian designs by fashion designers. And, you know, Victoria's Secret, you know, had one of their white models dress up in a feathered headdress, which is an incredible insult to tribal peoples to wear that headdress like that. And she's walking around in a buckskin bikini. And the fetishization of Native women continues today. And it's and again, the U.S. Justice Department, Amnesty International, women's groups, NGOs are all able to point to statistical evidence showing that this dehumanization of Native women contributes to the high rates of sexual assault and domestic violence that Native women experience at rates 3 to 4 times higher than non-Native women in the United States and Canada, for example.
So let's go back to the noble savage and why, okay, I understand why it creates, in terms of conquest, I understand why the dominant culture creates the notion of the savage because, among other things, it allows them to rationalize stealing their land and all that. Why, how does Western culture gain by creating the myth of the noble savage as well. Is this like the Christian notion of how women sort of get split into virgins and whores? Is it an analog to that, or is it something different?
Well, it's interesting. For example, the founding fathers oftentimes used the theme of the noble savage. Benjamin Franklin actually made his fortune publishing Indian treaties, and he would go out with the Philadelphia and Pennsylvania treaty commissioners and transcribe the speeches that the Iroquois, Haudenosaunee chiefs would make. Thomas Jefferson often pointed to the noble forms of expression of Indian chiefs that he was familiar with. There's this great tradition amongst the founders of recognizing a certain nobility in the savage lifestyle. Jefferson would oftentimes point to Indians as an example of a people who live by fewer laws rather than many, and they're better off for it. But ultimately what they would make the argument is, they made it against, I'm going to say this, and people may not, think it's serious, but the founders firmly believed in four distinct stages of civilization. This four stages theory of civilization goes all the way back to the Greeks and Romans. You find it in Adam Smith, who wrote The Wealth of Nations. You find it throughout the Enlightenment. And the four stages of civilization were primitive hunter-gatherers. Then there were pastoralists, like the ancient Scythians, who herded cattle or horses or sheep over vast ranges. Then were simple agricultural societies, and then there were the sophisticated, most advanced civilizations were commercial, industrial producing societies. And the founders, to a man, believed that progression of stages was inevitable, that nothing could stop it. And so just like savagery was doomed to be followed by more sophisticated types of civilization, the end point of civilization was Western civilization. And so what made the savage noble was also what made him doomed. That simplicity, that lack of cunning, the sort of honesty employed in treaty relations, the lack of not recognizing what the founders thought was no private property. While these could be noble virtues, when confronted by the inevitable consequences of what the founders believed in, quite frankly, I think many of the folks who deny global warming and climate change today are following in this four stages theory of civilization, that we're the greatest technological civilization that's ever lived. We'll solve our own problems. We have this great faith in our ability to keep on marching forward. And that anybody who holds us back, like the tribal peoples, like the Apaches at Rio, who are fighting the Rio Tinto mine, or the Navajos, we represent the Navajos in a human rights complaint against a ski resort here in Arizona. If you think of all these contemporary battles, oftentimes it's quaint, it's great, they hold on to their ancient ways, but we just really can't afford that anymore. Society has to move forward. So it's this myth of progress that's deeply embedded in the history of our country. It's found, as I say, amongst the founders. You can find it reflected in the Declaration of Independence, which talks about the merciless Indian savages and sort of this great vision quest that the founders had. This notion that progress is inevitable and that Indians, whether or indigenous peoples, whether they're noble or ignoble, doesn't really matter. They're doomed anyway.
Thank you for that. That's very... very sobering, obviously. And how do we there's two directions I want to go with that. One is I want to come back to that in a second, but I want to quote, there was somebody called an anarcho-primitivist, and that's sort of the modern version of the noble savage idea. And he quoted an anthropologist, and I want to read the quote from the anthropologist and then comment very briefly and then have you comment on it. And let's leave aside some of the problems in anthropology for just this moment. The quote is, he's saying why hunter-gatherers, why primitives in his language, are why they're so noble and great. He quotes this anthropologist saying about indigenous people, "Free scope is allowed for every conceivable kind of personality outlet or expression in primitive society. No moral judgment is passed on any aspect of human personality as such." And then he uses this to say why they're so free. It's just standard noble savage stuff.
Yeah.
But here's the important thing, is the next line by the anthropologist was left off by the person who was trying to promote this. The next line by the anthropologist is, Limitations to this expression naturally exist, but these flow naturally from an intense and clear-cut appreciation of life and from an acute sensitivity to group reaction. And so it seems to me, and let me know if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that in some ways, the reason I wanted to quote that is that kind of cuts to the heart for me of the noble savage idea, is that there's this idea that there are no, there's no society whatsoever, no rules, no anything. But the truth is, it's just a different, it's like you said about diplomacy. The point is to try to get along as a society, and that creates a different set of rulemaking. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even if you look at land and property, for example, the land ethic of indigenous peoples, you know, for, I mentioned the fact that we're our program represents the Navajo. We filed a petition against the United States for allowing the U.S. Forest Service to allow a ski operator to use reclaimed water, basically sewage water, on a mountain in northern Arizona that's one of the four most sacred mountains that the Navajos have. And that there's four sacred mountains. Not every mountain is going to be sacred. At the same time the Navajos were bringing that case, there were people in the tribe who were debating about running a gondola from the Navajo reservation down to the floor of the Grand Canyon to make money off of tourism. And so, yeah, it's not every particular spot of land is sacred, but there are spots that have religious significance, historical significance. They're gathering places, for example. And it's a more of a balance. The land ethic is to recognize that, that whatever you're going to do with the land, you have to live in balance with it because you know, nature can be very hurtful if you don't pay attention to her. And I think most of the tribal prophecies, most of the stories teach a healthy respect for nature. And because of that respect and gratitude, you know, the reason a mountain is sacred is because it provides you the deer. You say a prayer to that deer and a prayer to the mountain before you go there. It shows you where the medicines are. It's where your elders are buried, for example. There's specific reasons, and that's why you respect that land. And you use it. You know, there's no, you know, it's not every square inch of the reservation is going to be kept green and pristine forever. You know, the Navajos have a coal generating power plant on their reservation. That's just, you know, an accession to reality. What I think you find today and where I think the noble savage theme, you have to be careful with it because, again, it tends to romanticize and lock Indians in this sort of, you know, 18th and 17th century vision where they're a doomed society, whereas really some of the elements of the noble savage theme, this idea of a greater respect for nature, a greater respect for community, a greater respect for family, for connections, what you were talking about, that these are things that Western society might be able to learn from. And again, that's the point of my book. I do make the point that some of the great, you know, protest writing of Western civilization extends out of this use of the idea of the Indian as a primitive living simply and maybe having it better than we have it in our complicated, you know, way of life. And so it's, again, it's that use of this idea to help the West perhaps reflect upon the pace of its development, the scale of its development, that there may be something worthwhile learning about, not necessarily savage life, but the way that indigenous tribal peoples live.
So this all really brings me to, we've got like, 10 minutes left. And what do you want? This is sort of the wind up to the closing question. What do you want? How do you want your analysis to be used? How do you want your analysis to help, especially indigenous peoples, but then also society at large or many societies at large?
Yeah. First of all, I'm an Indian rights and indigenous rights lawyer. And so the people that I really, you know, want the book to benefit are indigenous peoples. That I've sat across the table so many times from government negotiators. I've appeared before courts, you know, where the assumption is that, you know, these indigenous peoples are backwards. Or we have a case right now in Belize, a land rights case. And the government is saying that, you know, you guys want to take us back to the Stone Age. And so very much like, you know, the N-word, you know, it wasn't that long ago. I always ask my students, you know, how many of you had grandparents that used the N-word as opposed to how many of you use it? You know, very much like the N-word, we shouldn't be using the R-word for that Washington football team, that where people appropriate Indian cultural styles for a cultural dress, ceremonial dress. For example, the Hopi are now fighting Paris auction houses over control of their sacred and ceremonial objects. Let's be conscious of the stereotypes that the West has historically used to exercise power and to justify domination over non-Westernized peoples. Very much like if we a consciousness of the language of racism used against blacks, for example, a consciousness of the language of racism used against Mexican Americans, which is in the news right now, thanks to Donald Trump. We don't have that same consciousness when people start stereotyping Indians, for example. So when you bring these stereotypes and this history of racism and the use of these stereotypes of savagery to the fore, it makes decision makers more conscious and makes them more honest. You have to call them to account. So that's the first way I want it to be used. I think the second way is to recognize the enormity of that task, that this racist idea of the inferior nature of tribal peoples goes back 3,000 years in the West. It's a long-term project. You're really trying to undo the cultural DNA of one of the most powerful, militarily and economically powerful civilizations the world has ever seen. This idea of the savage is literally imbricated in everything that the West is. And just like President Obama talked about racism being part of America, this racism against indigenous peoples is part of Western civilization and needs to be understood and appreciated and worked against. I think finally is that by reexamining our ideas about indigenous tribal peoples and where they come from, we recognize how culturally conditioned they are and can step outside of those cultural conditions and perhaps not necessarily more objective, but a different type of appraisal and looking at those cultures in their own terms. And I think what we've been talking about today, and you've brought it up a couple of times, is understanding indigenous tribal cultures in their own terms, their laws, their ways of using land, their family relationships, their sexuality, for example, and trying to develop a dialogue as opposed to just throwing stereotypes out there to see what sticks.
So you've said this, but I'm wondering if we can really – you've said this very well, but I want you to make this even more clear. The relationship between ideology and law.
Sure. Yeah, well, laws is an ideology in and of itself, but we tend to think of ideology as political perspectives. But I think the rights of American Indians are a perfect example. Why is it that Congress can give away Apache sacred land to a mining company? Why is it that the Forest Service can allow reclaimed wastewater to be used on a sacred mountain belonging to the Navajo? Why is it the government of Belize can deny the Maya people their land rights and lands they've occupied for 10,000 years? It's because of law and this idea called the Doctrine of Discovery. When Europeans came to the New World, their legal doctrine was if you discover lands occupied by savage, infidel, heathen, non-Christian peoples, that justifies the exercise of colonial power and domination. And this very idea, the Doctrine of Discovery, is taken over, as I show in my book, into American law by Chief Justice John Marshall in the 1800s. We see it reflected in the Supreme Court's decisions denying the legality of Indian treaties in the late 1800s. We see it in a case in 1955. Which denied Alaska's Aboriginal indigenous peoples any land rights in any part of Alaska. Why? Because of their savage nature and their lack of property rights. And so you have this ideology organized around the idea that savage peoples are inferior, and then you see that ideology taken over into law and used to justify the denial of rights. And that process is the same for indigenous peoples as it has been for women, as it has been for African Americans and gays. It's the use of this Western Christian ideology, this white male patriarchal ideology, to justify this set of privileges belonging to one group and not to another. And so that's the universal process I'm aiming at. If my book does anything, it just shows that the way that the West has justified its ideology of racial and cultural and sexual superiority over other peoples has been used on Indians, it's been used on gay people, it's been used on Mexican Americans. It's just part of it's part of a DNA of the West, and it is. It is an obsession, this identifying difference and using that difference to justify acts of oppression and domination.
So can you remember a couple, I'm sure you can, can you name just a couple of the great quotes from the Supreme Court that are just horrifying?
Yeah. In fact, the 1955 case that I mentioned is one of my favorites. A tiny group of Alaskan Native peoples were claiming rights to land they'd been on for thousands of years. And the Supreme Court, in a case called Tihitan versus the United States, says every American schoolboy knows that the savage tribes inhabiting this continent were deprived of their lands by force, and that the treaties negotiated were simply the exchange of a few trinkets for good behavior. Even the recently deceased Chief Justice, Justice William Rehnquist, in one of the worst opinions ever written by the Supreme Court, this one in 1979, a case called Oliphant v. Suquamish Tribe, that was the case that was really responsible for the inability of Indian tribes to prosecute non-Indian sexual predators and domestic violence perpetrators, because Rehnquist says in that case that Indian tribes are too uncivilized, that back in the 19th century, they had a want of fixed laws, and that their chiefs and headmen have no control over their passionate subjects, and goes on to rant about the backward, uncivilized nature of Indian tribes and why they've never been recognized as possessing criminal jurisdiction over their conquerors. And even Ruth Bader Ginsburg, one of the most liberal members of the court, an opinion that she wrote involving one of the five tribes of the Iroquois in New York, the Oneida tribe, cites the 17th and 16th century doctrine of discovery and a case called Johnson v. McIntosh, in which Justice Marshall says, you know, the savage tribes of this continent were deprived of their ranges by force. And there you have a 21st century judge citing language like that and thinking nothing of it. And again, it just shows this total lack of consciousness of the use of this language to justify oppression and the denial of legal rights to Indian people.
So, as you've made very clear, we're not, quote, just, end quote, talking about ideas and literature and history. We're talking about, as Catherine MacKinnon says, law organizes power. We're talking about the naked use of power.
That's right, and how culture helps organize the direction that power is going to be, you know, focused upon and the people it's focused upon. And if you have a dominant culture with a dominant ideology, which has a very, you know, narrow definition of what's normatively acceptable, then anybody who falls outside of those ranges is going to find themselves on the wrong side of the law. And quite frankly, that's the story of American history. It's a story we're watching, you know, right today in the last 2 weeks with the Supreme Court decisions running head up against some of those cultural assumptions that some people don't want to let go of.
So we have like 2 minutes left. What do you want people who... The reason I do these interviews is to try to get people to do things as well as change their minds. So what do you want people who hear this interview, what do you want them to know and what do you want them to do?
Yeah, I think the first thing they need to do is pay particular attention to the language that they use and the way they treat their kids. If they ask their children, do you speak an Indian language? Most kids will say two words, ugh and how. If they ask their kids, you know, where do Indians grow up? And they'll say a teepee. So I think the first thing what we need to learn is that children take on these stereotypical attitudes at a very young age. As my book shows, by the age of 3 years old, most children have learned the racial stereotypes that are going to be with them for the rest of their life, and they're hardwired. So it really does start with education. Is to yourself be aware, to call people on it, just like you might call somebody who, you know, perhaps uses an epithet to describe a gay person or a racial epithet to describe an African-American or Mexican-American, just to make people more alert, because we do know that if you change the language, if you change the discourse, you do begin to change attitudes. And that's sort of where my goal is to begin this process of changing attitudes.
Well, thank you so much, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Robert A. Williams, Jr. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you.